This is a provision that covers, it started out simply covering setting back an odometer on a automobile to misrepresent the amount of miles that the car can travel. But because of the unique Alaska situation, it was suggested that we broaden that. And what it refers to now is usage registering devices. And I must say that this is a uniquely Alaskan provision, and I think it's a good one. Usage registering device means any odometer, speedometer, recording tachometer, Hobbs meter, or other instrument that registers the miles traveled by the vehicle or the hours of engine use. So in most states, you will have a provision saying you can't set back the amount of miles traveled in an automobile. Well, since there are so many people owning airplanes in Alaska and motorboats, whereby the amount of travels, you know, is determined by the amount of hours of engine use, we brought in our definition. And you must act with an intent to deceive, and you have to sell, offer, or exposing for sale that propelled vehicle, knowing that the device has been disconnected, adjusted, or replaced, so as to misrepresent the miles traveled by the vehicle or hours of engine use. Very fairly tough standard, but in the cases where you can prove that, you've got the statute.
Judge Moody and I want to protect their votes.
It's one of the more unique Alaskan provisions in terms of expanding it to the Hobbs meters. Also, construction equipment. You would turn back the number of hours used in construction equipment. Section 730.
That's a very common thing.
It
would be if we didn't have a law.
The Consumer Protection Act only now refers to odometers, but you know, in fact, it can be done in other instances. 730, 740, and 750 deal with frauds, I guess, committed against, this is business and commercial offenses. These are dealing basically with frauds committed against people that are involved in business and commerce. And the first one is called defrauding secured creditors. And it covers the conduct of interfering with property subject to a security interest with intent to hinder the enforcement of the interest. For example, you have an automobile that there's a security interest in the bank, and you drive the automobile outside the jurisdiction so that the bank can later, you know, repossess the car or whatever. And this simply says it's an aim misdemeanor to do so. The statute can be committed in two ways, violated in two ways. The first is by intentionally failing to disclose the security interest of the buyer of the property, and secondly, destroying, concealing, removing, or otherwise dealing with the property was subject to the security interest with intent to hinder enforcement of the security interest. That type of prohibition doesn't turn into some law. Bill, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, but I don't believe that real estate could be subject to a security interest. That this, the term security interest only refers to personal property. Excuse me? I can verify that, but I believe security interest only does refer to personal property. You can only have security interest in personal property. If you transfer, for example, we discussed the need. That separate statute, say, covering, you know, you sell someone your house, and then you turn around and you sell it to someone else, and you abscond with the money. That's a form of theft. That would be covered under the general theft provisions. Bill, I'll check that and tell you if I'm wrong.
I'm wondering if it somehow relate to the lien laws
I think one way you can deal with it is to say security interest means security interest as defined in the UCC, and that's the, I believe the UCC limits it, the Uniform Commercial Code limits it to personal property. That seems to be what I learned in law school, and I'll check that out. Yeah. Possibly we should define security interest.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question here on this one, but I assume that's all different. I was ill yesterday. I took back in the office. Back on page 36, just across the page, I'd like to know what discussion you have, if I can take the discussion time. On line 7, number 2, we're talking about offering for sale, a businessman offering for sale, and he said, in a quantity sufficient to meet the reasonably expected public demand, and that's quantity specifically stated.
Did y'all have a discussion on that?
It's not necessarily a language, no.
Well, tell me, can you give me 2 minutes on that?
Sure. That language is taken directly, I believe, from Section 9 of the Consumer Protection Act. And what that would cover is...
Is that a regulation or a law?
That's a law. That's a law. It's criminal currently under Title 45. And what it would cover is kind of commonly thought of as bait advertising, where you you advertise something on sale, I don't know, for some ridiculously low price, and there's only one item on sale, and the intent is, of course, to get someone into the store and have them buy something else from higher item.
Who gets into that type of thing? Who gets into that type of thing? Oh, you know, who gets into that type of thing? Why would that at all pass?
I don't know. I would.
I know it's a leader, but I was curious about that. I mean, it's a business plan. It's like, you know, they say, well, you advertise your coat, you only have 10 of them. We think you should have 10.
Well, it doesn't say that you can't advertise only 10 of the coats. It simply says that you have to state that it's limited in the advertisement.
Well, as I see it,
I guess you're only hurt in the sense that you go down there thinking that you can buy something or drive over there and then you can't buy it because it's not there.
In a free enterprise, you can never do that again unless you approve it.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees, yeah, but
unless you live in Alaska, it's the only store.
The site on that, by the way, is 45-50.
I wish there were certain merchants I didn't have to go. They used to have this thing with net companies, and there's not a whole lot of them. It all comes from Japan anyway, and so it's all the same manufacturers. And so they'd do something to you. One year they sent me my nets after the season started, so I got real mad, of course, because I had to use my old nets, cost me $1,000. And of course they said, well, you'd never win a suit because you'd have to prove they intentionally did it, and I couldn't prove that they'd sold my nets to somebody else. They just said, well, we lost yours. And so I switched to the other company. Well, about 3 years later, they did a very similar thing. They sold me some product, and I said, well, it's not strong enough, and they guaranteed me it was strong enough, you know. And I told them that, you know, I wasn't going to pay them, and it turned out. So that's what I did. I was smarter that time. I didn't pay them all the money. So that's what we had two companies. You either went to one or the other.
The thing is also is that there's
more companies.
The statute requires, it has to be read in context with line 4, because false statement include but not limited to an offer to sell or provide property or services. If the offeror does not intend to sell or provide the advertised property or services in a quantity sufficient. In other words, you must show that intent. It's not sufficient, for example, that he only received 13 of them and he was intending to sell them. It's, you have to show that specific intent.
But he puts an ad in the paper because I know people have 10 of something left in the store and they must put that on sale and get it out of here. As long as he puts 10,
oh, sure.
Only 10 items left, then he's ready with it.
Yeah. Unless the quantity specifically stated in advertisement is one exception.
Right. Well, that's philosophical. Well, on this other one, when we talk about the fraudulent security creditors, you mentioned like taking an automobile out of the state. Where do you find that here? Are you reading into that removed?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
In Section 2, no, this removes the word. He destroys, removes, conceals. If you take an encumbered vehicle, an encumbered airplane, or an encumbered television set on your vacation, or whatever it is, and you take it across the state line, have you committed a crime?
You must prove that you had an intent to hinder enforcement of the interest. For example, I guess the example would be your example of people going on vacation, taking in their mobile home, a TV that is subject to a security interest, and they're planning to come back. I doubt very much that the court would not be able to find there's an intent to hinder enforcement of the security interest under those circumstances.
We used to get so many calls out of the group, and they said, would you this guy at the border, you know, they just left town, they're taking off their trailer, they've got a television set, they've got a whole bunch of furniture in that trailer they've got to pay for. Or the car that's pulling it is also made a down payment and they're getting outside.
So they were permanently moving these?
No, just vacation type trailer. They didn't have that much. Period. That's probably everything they own in the state. You can see whether they're going or not. When we stop them, they say, well, we're coming back. We're just going to see grandma. I guess that as long as they make that statement, it won't be until some period of time they don't come back.
You have circumstances in making the arrest, though, would be probably different, though, than circumstances in proving the case. Make the arrest, you just have that probable cause.
This doesn't give the businessman any real protection. In other words, as far as people taking something out of the state, if he wants to stop somebody as far as running through with his automobile, there's not much on this ground that they can do anything with. As long as the guy says, I'm coming back.
That's probable cause.
You know, I don't know. I really couldn't answer that in terms of what would be probable cause. I believe it. If the person, say, the example is the guy has a house in Anchorage and he's taking his car outside. I don't know, under those circumstances, he would have probable cause. If he's a homeowner.
Maybe it's mother law that I'm not concerned that might cover that, but I know we used to have.
I believe there's
still danger. The guy comes to town and charges everything in town and get on the plane.
It'd be difficult to correct the statute that said that you could not take property out of the state that was subject to security interest, period.
There was one. There wasn't one. Where they covered people out of state, you have to go to the state to clean.
That may be still in Title 28, and I'll check that. That hasn't been.
It is, but I think the law was there that you put to the clean home.
I'll check 28 on that. They may have, in fact, specific coverage. Section 7.
It would be real difficult to do that. Like, say I have a lien on my boat, you know, and run up and down the coast all the time. People do it all the time. Or people buy new ones.
Currently, the existing statute requires that you act with intent to defraud. We say intent to hinder enforcement. So I think we're offering an easier standard to approve. The intent to defraud standard in existing law being tougher than intent to hinder enforcement of the security interest. Defrauding judgment creditors on line 15 is an attempt to defraud a judgment. Well, first of all, let's try to clarify what a judgment creditor is. Say you have a civil suit and judgment is ordered against you in a certain amount, and you're obligated to pay that person that money after, you know, the suit is finalized. What this prohibits you from doing is disposing of your property with intent to defraud an existing judgment creditor. For example, selling it at a bargain price, or giving it a transfer, making a bulk transfer to a friend. Under current law, such transfers would be void. They would not be subject to criminal penalties. The commission felt that there was a need to protect judgment creditors in such instances and provided specific penalties in this situation. So if you ask me how does the code, you know, criminalize some conduct that may not be criminal under existing law, this is another statute. If you are existing judgment creditor and a person who is your judgment debtor disposes of the property with intent to defraud the creditor, you're violating the statute and would be named misdemeanor. And currently the only remedy is to say that the transfer is void. Fraud and insolvency, section 750 is also a new statute. And I think the commentary to this is fairly clear in the need for it. Say a person goes bankrupt in the state of Alaska, and he decides to file for federal bankruptcy proceedings. Well, the Federal Bankruptcy Act has a whole series of provisions regarding fraudulent transfers and acts that are prohibited under the statute. Well, in many instances, the person may desire to not go through the formalities of filing the Federal Bankruptcy Act and may want to work out an informal type of relationship with his creditors, and that's commonly referred to as a composition agreement. Well, in doing so, he may engage in conduct that would have violated the Federal Bankruptcy Act if he had filed for federal bankruptcy. The statute on fraud and on insolvency covers that type of conduct and makes it an A misdemeanor. And in order to violate the statute, you must know that proceedings have been or are about to be instituted for the appointment of an administrator, that term is defined, or that a composition agreement or other arrangement for the benefit of creditors has been or is about to be made. And knowing that, with that knowledge, and acting with an intent to defraud, you have to engage in one of the four types of conduct prohibited in the statute. And it covers disposing of the property, conveying a substantial part of the property, making a false statement to the administrator, or failing to disclose to the administrator the location of the property. Again, I think it's offering more protection to members of the business community. And that's it.
Well, line 23.
On
the first part on line 23 on page 37.
Yeah.
I understand the first part that it says are. Composition agreement or other arrangement for the benefit of creditors,
yep,
has been or is about to be made,
mm-hmm,
with intent to defraud the creditors.
All
right. Do you have any other comments to make on that one? Maybe I'm not.
Well,
that's a really clumsy section. The wording.
You mean in terms of
interpretation difficult.
An arrangement for the benefit of the creditor has been or is about to be made.
Yeah.
In
other words, say I you all my creditors, and I call you up and I say, let's meet at 3 o'clock tomorrow and we'll work out how to pay you all off. And that evening I transfer all my property. I think that's what it's attempting to get at. And it would also cover, of course, if we had an agreement already. You're trying, by saying it was about to, you're trying to.
That's the part that bothered me, is about to be made. I went along with you. In fact, it has been made. But when you say it's about to be made, then there seems to be a conclusion drawn there that it's the time you tell me if I don't pay this particular place out for the first time, you're going to do this and that.
No, no.
I go out and sell something.
So he has knowledge that he's about to enter into this agreement.
Yeah, we're referring to the debtor. The debtor, and he is going to enter into the agreement, and then he transfers the property. And he had knowledge that the agreement was about to be made. He would be covered by the statute, even though the agreement had not been made.
In other words, it's not that the fact that I call you up and say, you owe me money. It's not at that point, but it's at the point where you say, well, you're going to go into bankruptcy, essentially. And then at that point, you transfer.
How much of this is new law and criminal law?
Yeah.
The commentary says that it refers to 3440.010, and that only states the conveyances or assignments and so forth.
Yeah.
Boy, that doesn't address criminality.
I thought I made that clear, so it's going along.
It was probably coming through the door.
Okay. I said when I made my presentation that section 730 of Boarding Secured Creditors is now criminal. Section 740 and 750, not all that activity would be criminal under the law. There's an argument whether it would be or it wouldn't be. Let's assume, though, that it isn't. The statute, as I pointed out, simply says it's void. It does not have specific criminal penalties. You could argue that it was theft, but you have some problems doing so regarding, well, is it property of another, even though, you know, it isn't in their hands yet. And this is attempting to eliminate any problem as to whether it would be. But I'll make a statement it's not covered.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Brown.
Are there sections like this in other modern revisions?
Yeah, specifically New York. That's where we got the. Let me tell you, in terms of the frequency of occurring, the Boarding Secured Creditor would appear in just. I'm not aware of any revised code that doesn't have that. Fraud and judgments of creditors might be able to appear in about 50% of the codes. Fraud and insolvency would appear in maybe 23% of the codes. At the most, that may be a high figure.
Sure, I think they're kind of oddballs to me. Matters of this sort are normally dealt with in civil law remedies, and usually creditors and other interested parties are far more interested in bringing civil actions to set aside conveyances and defraud creditors, or bringing federal bankruptcy proceedings than they are in having somebody prosecuted for a misdemeanor while they're doing it. I mean, you know, if I'm a creditor, why should I force this guy to have to come with $200 bail tomorrow if we just got busted under this section? It seems to be self-defeating a little bit. I don't really like, particularly 750, but I don't like 740 or 750 at all. When we get to marking them up, we'll probably make a motion to delete one or both of them.
Just in terms of what occurred in the commission's level, there was significant, you know, split on the commission whether it should be criminal or not. And simply, same thing Fred was just pointing out. The thing is that we limited it I think substantially by requiring that you must prove a specific intent to defraud. And when you look at the conduct and you're trying to think of what kind of conduct you're discussing, the commission thought it would be parallel to theft. And that's why they decided to keep it a criminal, to make it criminal. But there was that discussion at the commission's level.
Now, these fraud and insolvency, yeah, the federal provisions provide criminal penalties if these acts are...
I'm not sure of the specific acts. I'd have to... The Federal Bankruptcy Act, though, is fairly complete, extensive document regarding fraudulent conveyances. And I could go in there and give these specific
but it's not
parallels. I believe that's correct, that there are some criminal penalties. I'll check that out.
Any other questions on these sections? Okay, page 47.
Yeah.
Oh,
Larry, you're about to move ahead.
Yeah.
Could we then pause to drop back for just a minute to page 28, issuing the bad check? Remember, Barry, you wondered whether this statute should exist?
Mm.
Well, I've increasingly begun to think that it shouldn't. It should just be eliminated. Maybe I'm...
should we just
eliminate it?
Issuing a bad check?
Yes, and having it simply prosecuted under general theft provisions. Tell me if I'm wrong on this, if you think I'm wrong. Now, whether issuing a bad check is a criminal act pivots on the policy of the bank. So the bank is really making the law, depending upon how the bank sees it. For example, some banks allow overdrafts for circumstances in which they allow. My bank, for example, I never asked them, they never offered the service, they always cover me. And if they change their policy tomorrow, my practice of the past several years based upon their practice now makes me I'm perpetrating criminal act because of their policy. But I don't think we should have a law that makes something a crime based upon the policy of the bank. Doesn't make sense to me.
The same would apply to a lot of things.
See,
you stole something and I guess I didn't want to file a complaint.
Well, no, it's not the same thing. You see, if the bank had a policy of honoring a customer on a small overdraft, it's an overdraft. If the bank, without consulting me, they can, I'm talking about when I was doing business at Alaska State Bank, they never consulted me about causing my bad checks to become overdrafts. But after I did it accidentally a couple of times, I began just doing it. They always covered me. I was never careful anymore. So my bad checks were
a large enough.
It's
kind of
a secret. I've been there 20 years and they never covered me.
Oh, we're anxious.
Under the statute, though, it does require that payment be refused.
Okay, but let's say that's my whole point.
Oh, you mean?
Let's say that the Alaska State Bank and Fairbanks was doing this while Al Fleetwood was there. And what to call it, down the anchor said, hey, cut that stuff out of there. Suddenly, old Carpenter, who has been, they don't consult me about changing their policies. My overdrafts aren't overdrafts, and I'm issuing bad checks. Meaning, again, that this, what is criminality here is being determined, it can be determined at the whim of the banking officials. I'm just asking if that isn't so. And if it's so, recognizing you can prosecute under general theft provisions or under provisions for defrauding, why bother with this thing that is kind of anachronistic now, based upon many banks causing bad checks to become overdrafts by their policy definition? Fred?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Carpenter, and we mentioned it in passing yesterday, but the way the section's written on page 26, again, one of the elements of the crime is the payment be refused. That is, we're having criminality turned
not on the action of the reported criminal, Mr. Carpenter or me or Bert Lance or somebody, but having the criminality turn on the action of the bank. Something that the bank does one day, it makes it such that there are people who are either aren't careful or something. It makes it such that nobody's a criminal, and tomorrow everybody doing the same thing, you have five criminals sitting there.
Or they can decide that Fred Brown is criminal and I'm not.
That's right. That's right. They could even do it inconsistent.
Let me explain to you why we added that payment. The reason we added that payment is refused was to just realize that people who just accepted the fact that people do write checks, knowing that you have insufficient funds with the authority to cover the check. You could change it, instead of payment is refused, you could say believing that there will be insufficient funds when the check is presented for payment. In other words, tie it into the culpability of the defendant at the time. So if you send a check out of state, and
you're awfully hard to prove.
Exactly.
I don't know whether that's what we need. We need something other than the words payment is refused by the guy on presentation.
I think I've been charged with redrafting the statute totally. I will try to come back with a number of alternatives there, including the alternative of knocking it out completely.
Right, I'd like to know what what we would be setting ourselves up for.
Well, a few things. One is the comment that there's a nice ad being run in Anchorage. I imagine most of you have seen it about one of the banks saying that, you know, he was talking to his guest because he was overdrawn. And he just saw our bank and he'll take care of it. You know, if you pay with that bank, they have a service to work out all these situations with you. Another bank will prosecute you for doing it.
Also, you get an NBA gold account, and that's part of their big deal. Is they give you a Bank of America card, and then if you overcharge, they'll automatically charge you against your Bank of America card. You sign to do that.
The second part of my concern was, and perhaps one of you guys can answer, the bad check problem is a bad one for the business matter, as you know, in this state, and particularly in the $10, $15, $25, $50 checks, people who want to write to cafe and breakfast and stuff, they got cigar boxes full of thousands of dollars worth, and they can't get anybody prosecuted. But in all the years that I used to, we get a complaint and a person would come in and say that they've got a $25 check for business and cabbage. I presented the district attorney. And first, they asked you, said, did you ask the guy what he did to collect that, what effort he made to collect that? So I said, yes, he went to him and said, well, this must have been overdrawn, so make it good on the first of the month. Well, the first of the month come by, and still the guy won't pay, so he wants to prosecute. Then they told him, and this is a general standard statement that they make, they said, well, what he's happened is that he's been going to a civil agreement with the guy, and that they won't prosecute. I don't think that stands up. If you show that you went out and negotiated a to return his money, then the merchant loses his right to go back and prosecute for the bad check, according to them. You might have some comment, somebody might, but I guarantee you that's what's told police agencies. And so the merchant stuck with the idea, if I ask the guy for his money, then I can't get a prosecution.
I'm not familiar with this. It is true that bad check isn't a good thing to prosecute. I'm assuming that.
But we'll prosecute, you know, and this is the inconsistency in the way we prosecute cases. We'll take a kid that steals 10 cents worth of chewing gum, we'll charge him with shoplifting, and he'll go through the biggest procedure you ever saw. Or just a shoplifting out of the store. But you can write the guy a check for $50, and nobody wants to prosecute him. So somewhere in the Czech law, I wish we could address ourselves somewhere, and I'd like to meet with some people who might have some ideas to strengthen that up.
What you could do, are you saying that those requirements should be put in the statute, in other words?
Well, I don't think the defense or anything else should be there, I think that any negotiation that the merchant, regardless of whether he tries to collect it, turn it over to an employment agency or anything else, doesn't believe me as a sponsor, goes through having written a bad check.
This has been a continuing problem in Anchorage, and we have discussed it with the Anchorage Police Department. Their position has always been that existing law was adequate. It was the district attorney's office where the problem was. They simply weren't prosecuting.
This is, I'm sorry, Ed beat me to the punch, but this is the second thing I think to bring up. This is a re-examine that it's a major problem of business everywhere, but in particular in Alaska, and in Alaska, in particular in Fairbanks, with the bad check. And maybe we should check the Department of Law and the DA's offices and find out their reasons for not prosecuting and explore this a little bit more thoroughly. And while we're at it, eliminate this this idea of mandate determining whether you're a criminal on the one hand, and beef up our statute either under the theft provisions or under a new bad checking statute, so that we have something that's that we can prosecute, that we want to prosecute.
Okay, we'll do two things. One thing, we'll get an official statement from the
We really go back to page 47 on the credit card? And I'll tell you what the problem with credit cards is. I did it. I personally tested the whole problem with credit cards. And the reason we have credit card fraud in the state is because nobody uses them right. It's that the whole idea of a credit card is that your signature's on the back, and you give the merchant your credit card, and they stamp it on, and then you sign your name. They're supposed to compare the signatures. I've told merchants this, and they say, oh, really? Is that what you're supposed to do? Yeah. They never tell their employees to do it. I've never had one in now 2 years do it. Never one.
You get a picture on something, too, and they never would.
Yeah, and so the reason that people get away with it is because of the original procedure, which is a really pretty foolproof method. You know, if I lose my credit card and somebody else tries to use it, they have to be pretty good forgers. You get a heck of a lot of them. People don't use them like they're supposed to, so that's one of the things we learned when we're going through this. So no matter how good we write the law on credit cards, until people start doing, merchants start doing what they're supposed to, this law is really not going to change a lot of things. It's not necessarily the merchants, but they don't tell their employees what to do.
That's true. I've noticed that also, yeah. Though occasionally in Anchorage now people will check.
I've never had one in 2 years, even in Anchorage.
Yeah. Credit cards are now, credit card frauds are subject now to comprehensive coverage in existing law. And the existing statutes are now found in Chapter 22 of Title 11. And it's entitled the Alaska Credit Cards Act. And it was enacted in 1970. I believe it was patterned after a model act. A number of states contain provisions regarding that. Now, the commission, in considering this area, was faced with one primary decision, And that decision was, are we going to retain a separate provision on credit card frauds, or were we going to treat that conduct as theft or forgery? Because anytime you have a credit card fraud, you're dealing with a theft or a forgery of a credit card. The commission decided, I believe unanimously, that we would simply retain the existing statute. And the reason was is that we now have on the books specific comprehensive coverage of this type of conduct. And in this one instance, we decided just leave it there. We have, you know, statutes covering theft of credit cards, forgery of credit cards, receiving goods that were obtained by unlawful use of a credit card. Since those statutes were new, we decided to simply keep it in the criminal code, change the language when necessary to reflect code terminology, and put the penalty provisions in. So we have, I believe, 7 or 8 statutes from existing law that are just included in the criminal code. What we did is basically the only, I think, primary changes we did was we consolidated a number of statutes. So if you turn to section 800, which is on page 47, what we did there is we simply consolidated 4 statutes covering theft or taking or retaining possession of a credit card unlawfully taken, theft of a credit card lost and mislaid, purchase or sale of a credit card of another, obtaining control of a credit card as a security for a debt. In section 800, there are no changes at all, other than the fact that we consolidated them. The penalty for that type of conduct is classified as an A misdemeanor, which is consistent with the maximum 1-year sentence authorized under existing law. If you go to section 810, you will see this section on forgery of a credit card, and that consolidates 2 statutes, forgery of a credit card and signing credit card of another. Now, this is classified as a C felony, and what this classification does, it increases the sentence authorized for signing the credit card of another. That kind of conduct now only carries a 1-year sentence. Under the code, a maximum 1-year sentence. Under the code, it will carry a C felony, which is 3-year maximum. So we increase that activity. We also include within the statute uttering a credit card with intent to defraud that's been properly, and uttering may be the wrong word. But
I was going to ask that.
But it is used.
It's harder here, I think, than writing a check. Excuse me?
Yeah, existing. I believe he refers to uttering. Yes.
Yeah,
it is.
Uses or draws on.
I would particularly like using. I like is a fraudulent use of a credit card is based on the same statute in existing law. And what we've done here is existing law uses the term property or, I'm sorry, existing law uses the phrase money, goods, services, or anything else of value to describe what can be obtained. We substituted the phrase property or services, which includes that activity, which includes those items. Now, punishment for this section is consistent with the code's general provisions on theft. And if you recall, the theft statutes set up basically 3 degrees of the crime, depending on how much money or property was obtained. If over $500 was obtained, it will be a Class C felony. If under $500 but over $50 was obtained, it would be a Class A misdemeanor. If under $50 obtained, it would be a Class B misdemeanor. So we subject this section to the, we subject that scale to the section on fraudulent use of a credit card. Now there's one important change that should be noted. Under existing law, the provision says that it will be a felony under existing law if you obtain property exceeding $500 during a 6-month period. We do not include that provision because we have a better one in the code. What we say, and this applies to all theft offenses, this applies to all theft offenses in its general provision, it says, in determining the degree of an offense under the chapter on theft, which credit cards is one article, amounts involved in criminal acts committed under one course of conduct, whether from the same person or several persons, shall be aggravated. Let me give you an example. You have conduct involving a person that possesses a credit card that was fraudulently obtained, say, and he goes into a shopping mall in Anchorage. He uses it in one store and he obtains $35 worth of merchandise. He goes to the next store and obtains $100. Next store, another $200, say. That this simply provides that in determining the degree, you add up all the dollar amounts. And if the person in that one day obtained more than $500, he's going to be a felon. And we discussed that briefly this afternoon in terms of that may spring from existing law. And it's making clear that it doesn't have to be from this, it does not have to be from the same person, it could be from several persons. So you could, we could go to, for example, different sections of the store and obtain the property. And you're not looking at it as, you know, 17 acts of fraudulent use. You're looking at it as one act and to aggregate the property. So, and that provision, again, applies for every theft offense in the code and is a very important one. And again, I think it changes existing law and it allows for aggregation.
I can go back up through A-2.
Okay, you'll have to tell me what page. I'm not looking at the statute.
40.
Okay.
A-2.
Yeah.
Line 8.
Okay.
Can you give me an example of what that says?
Oh, sure. Without the authorization, it completes a credit card by adding any of the matter other than the signature, which an issuer requires to return a credit card issued by before the credit card may be used by the cardholder. Okay, perhaps he's obtained a credit card from a friend of his who works for Bank Mercard, and it doesn't have the, there's a number of things that are embossed on it regarding the bank number and the effective date. So, for example, say he changes or he adds good through and it's or expired and it's at 778 and he adds 780 to keep it longer. But this refers to completes it. So I think really what we're talking about is he obtains a credit card, has it been completed, and he adds the effective date there.
See, one thing completes a credit card. Yeah.
You have trouble with the concept of completing.
Yeah. But completes the credit card by adding any of the matter an issuer requires to appear on the credit card. Completes it. He's actually physically changing the credit card. Is that what that means?
I think it's completing in this section again is he obtains the blank credit card. He embosses it.
One of the things we can do is that if I get a credit card, I can have you. It'll have my name printed on it, but I could authorize you to sign your name right on it here. Even though it has my name down here.
Yeah, you can get through it.
Right? And so.
I think what it's aimed at, again, we didn't change it. I think what it's aimed at is when you're getting the blank credit cards and you're just embossing it yourself and selling it to people, I'll make it for you for, you know, $500. I will put anything here you want on it.
Hang on.
Sure.
Which an issuer requires to appear on the credit card issued by it before the credit card can be used by a credit card.
Well, one way to clean it up is to delete issued by it. I don't see it that.
Excuse me? What, issued by?
Issued by it, if that's serving the purpose of it.
Not really. I get clarifies perhaps an ambiguity there. I mean, but in other words, well, it's not important to go through. I think you probably could have gone through.
I get the feeling here, and I don't have to put my finger on it, but you should have a lot of pages to say there's very little that we're going into all this.
On the credit card?
Yeah, it's still just passed a law that public use of a credit card for over $50. Are we going into all this business?
Well, again, I don't. Again, it isn't, again, the committee just simply decided to retain existing law on the subject. We didn't add any new language on it. This is on the books now.
It was passed in
1970. And all we did, I think, is eliminated some language, frankly, because we consolidated a number of statutes. For example, if you, you know, on...
It just seems like you could round it up about everything you said in one paragraph.
I wish you could. I wish you could. Yeah, some people don't even address themselves to credit cards as a separate article. They simply treat it as a form of theft. But since it does appear on the books, and because people know that there's a section on credit cards, the commission has said, let's keep it, instead of consolidating that. If the commission directs, I can make the appropriate changes and just treat it as a form of theft. It depends.
Well, there is this, what we got into was on this, there was two things. Well, the legislature recently, you know, enacted this, so, you know, did the commission want to just throw it out? And the other thing was is that everybody, like in terms of this one, merchants, the prosecutors,
the judges. Everybody is familiar with dealing with now with credit card crimes specifically under these. So do we want to change that? Because some people might think that this means now we don't have credit card offenses. And so there was that came up, the argument that some things we just retained because of the sake of familiarity. For instance, on the names of offenses, we stuck with kind of the common usage, even though just because people would begin to think that we didn't have that crime anymore, we didn't want people to get that impression. So there, you know, that was some of the reasoning that people went there.
My own opinion is I'm a purist, and if we could have put it in the theft and forgery, I would have liked that, but I think the arguments the other way are persuasive in the sense of people know where it is, they know where to turn.
But there really isn't, if we were to eliminate any of this, there's not any activity prohibited by any of these sections that wouldn't be prohibited under theft.
That's correct. The only thing I would want to do is to make a specific reference in, like, the definition of property, say it specifically includes a credit card, or in forgery, and we're defining what an instrument is to say includes a credit card. And you know, that's easily done, and I can do it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah,
Lisa? If we're going to think about that, I mean, certainly it seems like reasonable thing to do. I would like to know why the legislature went to all the trouble.
I can probably tell you.
Well, we didn't have a consolidated theft offense for one thing at that time.
And also, another reason is goes back to the bad check thing. Because a credit card, there's a number of problems looking at credit cards transactions as ordinary theft. And also, it's kind of the promise to pay in the future, which ordinarily was not covered by. That's actually probably the best reason, is because if you didn't have the credit card offenses in existing law, you might not be able to treat it as theft. Under the code, you could. In terms of what other states have done,
I mean, under the code, even if we deleted this exception and put it under, as you suggested, under the definition.
Yeah, and you could, but not under existing law. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what other states have done, I'm only aware of one other state, Arizona, that has retained a specific comprehensive coverage of credit card offenses, like as we have. Now, no matter, even if you knock out this section, this whole article completely, you're still going to have to keep certain sections as separate statutes. For example, we have decided, at least in existing law, that if you act with an intent to defraud and you obtain control of a credit card as security for a debt, it's specifically covered. And I'm not too sure you could fit that in under another statute. So you may have to have one statute covering those odd little credit card offenses. It's not a thing we get forgery. So I could, if you'd like, I could come up with some thinking about that and show how it's begun. It doesn't require very much amendments.
Are you talking about
consolidating it?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm being forced to stand over here.
Step back. You're in the room.
The purpose of the code is we're rewriting and some of the arguments for a new code could be lost if we could have put this kind of stuff in there, and it could be said in a paragraph before, and then someone has to rewrite a new code and take all this stuff they said 10 times in or out. So anywhere out and we find something that doesn't have to be in there while we're cleaning it up, let's clean it up and don't put stuff in there that's not necessary.
I think also that the commission simply just deferred a lot of time to something was, again, recently passed, to respect the legislative decision to keep it in there, and to keep it in unless there were some problems.
We won't weaken the code if you do.
Oh, no, I could probably actually straighten the idea of a comprehensive code.
And I appreciate your
doing. Oh, I'm sorry, I got a couple more. But, frankly, I could go through the rest, but there's only three more sections and there's no earth-shaking changes. We simply consolidated, and instead of using the term, we used a right culpable mental state instead of the existing term.
You're talking still about the
credit cards, yeah.
Going back to Bill's comment, should we keep this in this form? Maybe in on line 8 of page 48, where he gets the word complete, we could just make it the word forges, because that's what we're talking about. Complete.
you see, that points out why we don't need this. Because when we say forgeries, we're really referring to conduct specified as forgery in another section. So let's cover it under the other section.
Yeah. Is there any more questions on this section? Okay, we're up. Next one is on page 57. Expenses against the family.
New show. We're definitely getting to the stranger offenses.
We're getting abusive.
Abusive of corpse is coming up in the intervals. We're on 57, not for abusive of corpse, but family offenses. You know, the common characteristic about Tenant Fair 5 is that a lot of the same things gave commission some trouble, and offenses, that's why we kept it for the last. Offense against the family was certainly an area where we had some problems. And what we have done here is we've created 8 offenses, and I'm going through them really briefly, and then we'll go into more detail. The first one is endangering the welfare of a minor, and that's divided into 2 degrees. The most serious is a C felony, and the second degree one is the A misdemeanor. The C felony basically covers child abandonment. The A misdemeanor can be endangering, and second degree can be classified as a child abuse statute. Of all the provisions, this was the toughest. Then we get to our criminal non-support statute, failure to provide support. Then we have failure to provide visitation with a minor child, and as a violation, I'm not going to go into very much detail on that since you just passed it last year. It was just passed last year, the newest thing in the code in terms of recently passed legislation. Then contributing to the delinquency of a minor, unlawful exploitation of a minor, which is could be called child pornography, unlawful marrying, which is bigamy, and then failure to comply with order of a peace officer to leave dwelling, which is our spouse abuse statute. So there's some very interesting provisions here. And I know Representative Phillips has a comments on the exploitation of a minor. So, endangered welfare of a minor, again, is a felony, and that section is on page 57. And this covers deserting a person under the age of 10 years old under circumstances creating a substantial risk of physical injury to the child. And it could only be committed by the parent, guardian, or other person legally charged with the care of the child. Now, why do we need a statute like this? If the minor is exposed to serious physical injury, the conduct would be reckless endangerment. But that's only an A misdemeanor. So this is a C felony. And also, reckless endangerment requires an exposure to serious physical injury. This only requires an exposure to physical injury. Again, it's looking at intentional desertion of children under the age of 10 years old. And why did we pick the age of 10? We felt at the age of 10, over the age of 10, it would be likely that the children would be able to call their plight to the attention of others. For example, what we're really getting at here is leaving the child in the garbage can. That kind of circumstance. If you put a 15-year-old kid in the garbage can, it's likely to get out, and you don't have those same problems inherent there. So this is the most serious type of conduct. Now, it's important to stress, and it's important to stress for the record, that if the child suffers physical injury or suffers any serious physical injury, or it gets killed as a result of the abandonment and dies, you're not going to prosecute under this. You're going to go under your murder provisions or your assault provisions. For example, if the mother recklessly causes serious physical injury to the child under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, you got an A felony. This is just cases where she may leave the child, deserts the child in the garbage can, and the child is found, an hour later unharmed. But you could say under those circumstances, the child was exposed to a substantial risk of physical injury. Okay, that's your abandonment statute. Now, endangering in the second degree, again, was very difficult. I'm sorry.
Is there a time element involved in desertion?
Well, desertion requires, the dictionary definition of desertion is recorded in the commentary, requires an intent to permanently sever the relationship. And it wouldn't cover a temporary physical separation. The example I gave, it would not cover the parent who left the child in the custody of a relative for two days, even though she had agreed to return in 4 hours. That may be covered under the second degree provision. we really wanted to get serious conduct here. We didn't want the statute to interfere with, you know, conduct that may be questionable. As you know, the parents may be displaying questionable conduct, but the remedy in that situation should be civil action as opposed to criminal. That's what the commission concluded. So we're talking about a serious desertion there. I think the commentary emphasizes that. Now, the second degree provision covers four acts, and here we're talking about children under 13, and the culpable mental state for this is criminal negligence. I may have some problems with this, and you'll have to decide whether that's a sufficient mental state. It covers four acts. The first is leaving the child unattended under circumstances to create a substantial risk of physical injury to the child. It doesn't require desertion. It could require, you know, you leave the child, a three-year-old child, alone for 2 hours in the house. And it could be under the circumstances creating a substantial risk of physical injury to the child. Another example would be leaving the child locked in a car for about 3 or 4 hours in the dead of winter. That would fall under that conduct, even though you were intending to return to get him out after you did your shopping. Subsection 2 refers to subjecting the child to cruel confinement. Cruel confinement is not defined, but I think it's referring to locking the child in the closet. That was the type of example that was given in the code, during the discussions. Now, subsection C, 3, refers to subjecting the child to cruel punishment. All right, what is cruel punishment? If you physically abuse the child, you're going to be guilty of an assault. And again, it's important to stress that if the assault requirements are met, you should prosecute under the assault statutes. But what happens, and this is the example given, if the parent smears feces in the child's face, is that an assault? Well, it probably is, actually, because simple assault refers to touching the person with reckless disregard for the offensive nature of the conduct on the person. So we may have a duplication of that, but that's what we're talking about. Punishment that does not reach the level of an assault. And again, it's an A misdemeanor. The other thing, of course, is that we're only talking about the culpable mental state of criminal negligence. So it's a lesser burden of proof. Finally, depriving the child of necessary food, clothing, or shelter. And I guess the example here would be the babysitter who was left in custody of the child, say, for a day or 2 days and failed to feed the child. That would cover that type of conduct. And the main problem here was, you know, does this criminal statute here covering that conduct? And if so, how do you draft it? Well, the main problem I have, perhaps, the culpable mental state of criminal negligence in it. And it's important, again, this is not intended to supplant the sections on assault. If you have an assault, if you have a homicide, you're going to go under those. This is the bottom line section. And the commentary stresses that the use of criminal sanctions when you're involving a parent is rarely appropriate. It's the remedy of last resort. There is one beneficial thing, just finishing. There's one beneficial thing here is that it covers any person having custody of the child, so it would cover the babysitter. So you're not necessarily interfering with the parental relationship.
I have a question on this non-support. Who determines that? Well, I'm on page 58. Who determines necessary food and necessary clothing and necessary shelter and necessary medical attention?
Okay.
Does the police officer do that, or does he decide whether he thinks the child's getting enough to eat, or whether his clothes are right, or whether he should have medical attention?
It's going to be a court decision.
It's going to be determined by the court.
Okay.
I mean, there would be a complaint, perhaps, that I call up and I say my neighbor's starving her child, and you come over and you make an investigation or whatever you would do, and then the court is going to decide. But that phrase, by the way,
that solves my problem. I was getting this would be done in court. That would be a charge of non-support. In other words, that's not a criminal act. The police could go out and charge me with criminal non-support. Can they go down and sign a complaint for me because they don't think my kids are getting enough to eat?
Could they have a complaint? You mean, in other words, go down?
What are they arrest me for?
It's a misdemeanor.
Yeah, well, then they can. If they come to my house and say, we feel that your child's not eating enough, or can you arrest me for under this law?
I'm not too sure in terms of the, I think you have to have a warrant sworn out.
on it, and if the magistrate found probable cause...
It's a misdemeanor committed in my presence.
Mm-hmm.
If I go there and I see...
Okay, now you're the peace officer and you're going there.
Or that I think he should be at a doctor because that looks serious enough to me that he should have seen him, and the mother doesn't think so.
And is you as a peace officer now?
Or babysitter, yeah.
As a peace officer. Well, you, peace officers have the right to arrest for misdemeanors committed in their presence, I believe. And if you believe that that's a misdemeanor committed in your presence, you, I guess you have the right.
Does this put the truancy law back in?
Truancy? Well, I'm not really familiar with the truancy.
About education, if you get someone that's not getting I'm going to be asking some real crazy questions. I just want to get out of my mind. If it says here...
This, by the way, this statute...
Education.
Yeah, this statute is, again, is taken from existing law in terms of what the requirements are in terms of support. Food, care, clothing, shelter, medical attention, education, that would apply in the existing statute. Now, your question would be, the parents, this only applies to persons legally charged with the support of a child under 18.
We
so,
didn't have this under child neglect, didn't we? Or what was that misdemeanor? I forget the name of the statute, but if you report child abuse or something.
Yeah, well, that would, if you're referring to the ones on reporting injuries, I'm not this has always been under the non-support statute, which is 11. Well, it's existing law, essentially. I'll tell you, there's one. Are we off endangering? I didn't have really a chance to talk about non-support, but...
I want to go back to all of them, but that's
finished. Okay, let me talk about the non-support statute. Okay. Under existing law, the non-support provision applies to children as well as spouses. The Criminal Code Commission decided that the non-support provision should not apply to spouses, that should be dealt with civilly. Non-support of spouses is a civil matter, not a criminal matter. And that is consistent with, you know, the bulk of revised codes. And in terms of the statute, in terms of defining support, we took that definition directly from existing law, which happens to be, again, similar to the definition appearing in revised codes. Now, if you ask me what education means, I may have some problem with that. We did raise the age of the child from 16 to 18 in terms of non-support. Now, I think there's one error here, and it's on line 5, and it says he refuses or neglects without lawful excuse. Under existing law, it says willfully. I think the culpable mental state intentionally should be there. So you have to show, I think in your example there, that you have to show that it was a conscious objective to deprive a child of support. And I think that's the kind of level of culpability you would like here, to specify intentionally.
Police generally don't file these kind of complaints as much as the social service.
Well, as I understand it, you see, the biggest debate on the commission was, do we keep a non-support statute? And we, in part of, when I do a presentation before the commission, the first review, we discuss the material with people involved in the everyday aspects of it. And I spoke to Wade Lacey from the APD, and I spoke to people from social services, and also from the PD. And there was really basic feeling that you don't need a statute, that you don't need a provision like this. But then the commission ended up concluding that you may have particularly aggravated instances where there's nothing that you can do but go criminally. And you've got to have that option. But I should say that there was some substantial question of whether you want to keep a non-support statute in the criminal code. We ended up keeping it. I'm not too sure where we're at.
It kind of moved down a little bit if you were paying support.
Well,
the first thing about the support statute, what you're talking about is not support payments. This does not refer to support payments, child support payments, for instance, at somewhere else.
Yeah, that's dealt with in terms of the civil. There is a whole mechanism for enforcing it.
Yeah, I know that's true, but this doesn't deal with that at all.
No,
this is talking about direct physical sustenance. Is that really, basically, what you're talking about?
Yeah,
the
food, care.
Doesn't feed their child.
Mm-hmm. Care, clothing, medical attention, education. That little thing there about medical attention there is from existing.
Could you go through for me the kinds of other offenses that people may be charged with when they do a really bad endangering of the welfare or a bad non-support? You mentioned that they could be charged with
assaults
and things like that.
Yeah. We really are only talking about assaults and homicide. And with the criminal homicide, we have three crimes. And if you could show that the person deprived the child of support with intent to cause death, you have your murder. If you could show that he didn't give the support, the food, recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, i.e. the kid was locked up for 10 days, never gave him food, said unintended cause death, the kid dies, that's going to be murder also. If you recklessly cause death, perhaps under circumstances not manifesting extreme indifference, you're guilty of manslaughter, which is an A felony. If you can't show reckless and all you show is criminal negligence, you'll be guilty of a C felony, which is criminally negligent homicide. So that's your murder sections.
Yeah.
Now assault, I'm just trying to, if you recklessly cause serious physical injury to the child, which is, I'm not too sure that would apply here, because serious physical injury I think is defined as disfigurement, and I'm not too sure that concept would apply to children here in terms of non-support. Well, I guess it would. Physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death. And physical injury means physical pain or impairment of physical condition. So if you deprive a child of support, food and he's starving, he's near death, you've got an assault and important reason of assault. So
what I'm trying to get at is, it seems to me that these misdemeanor charges are pretty light,
sure,
considering what is being described here. And, I mean, if you subject a child to cruel confinement, it seems to me you should be charged with more than a Class B misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could probably be charged under unlawful imprisonment for that cruel confinement thing. That statute's been regressed somewhat. Unlawful, of course, if you sexually assault the child, that would be covered as a very serious sexual assault. But cruel confinement, if you restrain another person under circumstances which expose the person to a risk of serious physical injury, which probably is what we're getting in cruel confinement, locking out for a substantial period of time, you'd be guilty of unlawful imprisonment, which is a C felony in the first degree. Okay, but let me give you the only time I think that these are helpful is when you recklessly expose the child to a substantial risk of physical injury. Physical injury, recklessly exposing, and there's no injury. Under the code, the closest thing we would have is reckless endangerment. And then you have to expose the child to a substantial risk of serious physical injury. So the proof thing is going to be a lot easier, you know. And I don't know, I think perhaps in terms of prosecution discretion, when the prosecutor has the appearance there, it may be more forceful to point to this saying, hey, look, here's endangering the welfare of a minor in the second degree, subject to the child to cruel confinement. This is you. You know, you keep it up, you're going to...
Well, that's the other side of the coin of what I just said is that I'm afraid if someone murders their child, they may down for this.
All I would say, Lisa, is I say, on page 62 of the commentary, in reviewing the code provision that followed, it must be remembered that the code's general assault and criminal homicide provisions provide comprehensive coverage of conduct involving physical abuse of children. The code's endangering the welfare of a minor statutes merely supplement that coverage. If it can be established that the child suffered serious physical injury or was assaulted by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon, prosecution should be brought under general assault provisions, which are classified more seriously than the crimes discussed below. And yeah, I didn't think the specific reference to homicide was necessary, and that's kind of why I kept, you know, on the record saying that that's the intent of the commission. If you have a homicide, you're not going to prosecute as endangering in the second degree. And you have to decide whether you want it or not, because
yeah.
it was sure debated. This got in the last day of the meeting, and it was voted up and voted down and then voted up again.
Yeah. Or Lisa, did you have some?
Well, on another section.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I comment on this one? I think you need a section. It seems like if we had the terminology in there, like we have criminal negligence.
Yeah.
Where you say a failure to believe it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. You know, some standard by which we could, I think,
I had some real reservations about maybe somebody, social worker out there, and decide all of a sudden that you're in violation of the law. And if you are, and if you really do agree with the police, some of this stuff is not severe enough. But I could just see a lot of, there's poor people in the world, and there's people who choose to live lifestyles that we don't like. And if I were to judge them, I'd think they're neglecting their kids. Quite frankly, but they choose to live that way. And really fundamental determination is that that's something that a reasonable person that fits under the definition of criminal negligence, that any reasonable person would think that this child starving to death or it's that type of thing, then maybe you could arrest.
Thank you. You helped me out in that statute. Yeah, because, I mean, that is the kind of standard you're talking about. It's a gross deviation. It's not conduct that is necessarily, you don't approve of. It has to be pretty damn gross.
That word approve of is what worries me.
Yeah.
But if we have a standard, that would, negligence seems reasonably, or somewhere in there maybe.
Yeah, thank you. Terry, in terms of, since Representative Phillips is here, maybe I could look at the unlawful exploitation of a minor to cover that. Because
does anybody have any questions on these sections, the ones we're just talking about? Okay, let's go to that.
Yeah, that's on page 59. Unlawful, the commission was faced with the issue of how to deal with people that employ or use children to engage in sexual acts for commercial purposes. What the result was, the statute you see on page 59, line 18. Now, the statute is limited in that it applies to conduct in the state, and the person has to act with intent of producing for any commercial purpose a live performance, film, photograph, negative, slide, book, or magazine that depicts such conduct. And doing that, you knowingly induce or employ a child under 18 to engage in, or photographs, films, or televise a child under 18 to engage in explicit sexual penetration, sexual contact, bestiality, or a lewd exhibition of the person's genitals. Now, through a mistake, we didn't define sexual penetration and sexual contact in this section. Those definitions appear in the sexual offenses article. And when we're working on the bill, we'll have to move those definitions. But sexual penetration is very broad. It covers any intrusion into any anal or genital opening, and fellatio and cunnilingus, and contact would cover specified touchings of genitals or anus or female breast. And so that's our statute, see, felony.
Is there any questions from anybody?
Are we going to hear some testimony? Oh, I thought maybe you were
I was just going to
add a few brief comments on this section of the criminal code. And I talked to Terry earlier about wedging my bill into this section. Looking at it, I don't think it makes any reference to the transportation of such materials, which I have in my bill. And the other major item that I noticed between the two is the class of the felony. The bill that I have here, minimum offense would be 10 years and $25,000, and a maximum would be 20 years and $50,000 fine. And under the criminal code, it has a Class C felony, which I believe the maximum is 3 years and a $10,000 fine for the first offense. So, to put it briefly, I personally think that the felony is not stiff enough in this type of offense. And secondly, I would like to see very much the statutes to cover transportation of such material. If you would constitutionally and to the judgment of the committee here. Oh, I have that intention. I have that's the only two objections I have. It's basically the same except for those two. Maybe the difference.
But when you say transportation, you include display?
Well, like, let's say a mail order catalog, or ordering something from the States, and they're shipping it up through commercial airlines or trucking or something
you
else,
carry,
or personally
you carry
hand carry it or whatever. I know it's kind of hard to enforce, but still like to see something in there to cover this area up. If you like, I'll just give you a copy of the bill.
Okay, well, just what's number?
554.
We did that. I could have turned the wallet around.
Where?
Yeah,
airport.
Do you know that bill? If there were passports, I'd like to verify that you have a passport or something about.
Yes.
Well, I have it right here.
Okay.
If you want it.
The section I'm referring to is from,
and I have a sponsor substitute, which I have drawn up, if you want to, it's actually 1-2, I can make a Xerox copy of it.
Okay.
That's the, what I'm after.
Okay. Very.
Can you tell me a little rationalization of why we came up with C instead of AAA?
Donnie?
I really think that would be the most serious, one of the more serious offenses in the state.
Well, you got it.
Around out here 3 years or something for doing something like that.
Okay, and considering it though, you have to realize this is in addition to the penalties we have in sexual offenses. So if you have a person engaging in sexual penetration with a child, say under 13, that's an A felony under the code. This is simply employing the child. We don't have a specific coverage of bestiality in the code as an offense. It's a separate difference.
Yeah, but if you do it to a child in here, it's only 3 years.
No, no, if you do, I'm not sure what you mean by do it to a child. I mean, if you
induce a child to go out and photograph it having relations with an animal, it's 3 years, right?
That's correct.
And yet, any other place, it's quite a thing. And I mean, how about it? I think that's kind of all you need.
It's
what I was saying is that I don't believe that the conduct of bestiality is covered within the. In other words, we don't prohibit a man from screwing a sheep in the sexual assault articles, and consequently, we don't apply it to children also. But let me point out though how the statute was drafted up.
You go back to whisper.
Okay, but if you're guilty of rape,
yeah,
you can't just be, you can be prosecuted under both rape and
sure.
Theory.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you
but
can be prosecuted under both.
If you take part in the movie, in other words, you can be prosecuted. But if you're the guy that's going out and getting the child and bringing the child in and running the camera, then it's a Class C.
It's tricky, I'll tell you. The reason it's tricky is because we define sexual assault in such a way as to say that the person, I have to work that one out. I've started that once in terms of looking at it as an accomplice to the sexual assault. In other words, I go out and I hire a, I believe that's correct, Terry, now that I got through it. I go out and I hire a person under 13 to engage in sexual penetration with a person that's 12. I believe that I would be an accomplice, I'd have to go through it to be sure, I believe I would be an accessory to that crime, and I would be guilty of the acts of that child engaging in the penetration. That's correct. So I would be guilty of an A felony under those circumstances. The reason the statute, in terms of, we were aiming at protecting children within the state, and that's why we didn't extend it to transportation, because that exceeded that goal.
Well, then as you've just described it, it would follow, would it not, that this should be an A felony, since what you just described is the kind of conduct that's in that case.
Wouldn't you prosecute him under there and here? You could.
Yeah, obviously you could, but why make the difference?
Some material, though, is not, and it would not be an A felony, for example. It covers lewd exhibition of a child's genitals. That is not specific, you know, since it doesn't involve two people, it would not be covered under the general sexual offenses article. So you've got a mixed bag of activity here in terms of what you're an accomplice to. Some of the things you may not even be an accomplice to. In other words, a lewd exhibition of your genitals is not necessarily an offense under the code. So it, you may not be able to tie it in to a specific...
What code? It is right here. What code do you...
No, no. If you're hiring a person to do it, it's an offense. That's correct. Oh, or it comes on...
I see.
And also the decent exposure, for example, only a misdemeanor. So if you would be an accomplice, you know, that's another example. Say I hire someone to engage in a lewd exhibition of his genitals and or her genitals, and the offense we're talking about is a decent exposure, which is an A misdemeanor. Well, I would be an accomplice to that offense, but I would only be guilty of an A misdemeanor. This would say I'm guilty of a C felony.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe what you're saying is that this is in the wrong section of the code. Maybe it should go over in the section that has to do with sexual offenses. Is that...
Well,
is there such a section?
Sure. Oh, yeah, there is a section. It, I
maybe that's what should happen, and then we can integrate it better and get the divided or whatever. Is that some reason?
Yeah, I don't think there's any particular reason why you have some family offenses, other than it came up towards the end when we were still discussing family offenses
involving children. And that would make it possible to divide some of the offenses up and assign penalties more in line with what the real offense is.
I think any of these that I read should be an A offense. You know, I think you can move them or change them, which I agree with if you made an A felony.
I have to say,
one of these with a child is
there's some constitutional problems here that you can't just glance over, and it's simply the fact that this statute does not speak in terms of obscenity. It simply speaks in terms of certain prohibited acts, regardless of whether they are seen or not. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that in regulating such conduct, you have to use the least restrictive means to do so, simply because First Amendment rights are involved. Now, there's a recent case that just came out just 3 months ago. This is a very fast-breaking area of criminal law, and the Federal District Court in New York was looking at New York's juvenile obscenity statute, which was the grandfather for all of these, and it provided felony penalties, and they make the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, I'm sorry, let me be sure I'm not correct, that, well, the side here is that the use of felony statutes to prohibit dissemination of such material is constitutionally suspect.
But that's
and
not what we're doing under this. We're just talking about the production.
You mean the production?
Under this grant.
Okay.
We're not talking about the dissemination or the transportation.
Okay, I was directing in terms of dissemination and transportation. I don't think the court has ruled yet on the production of it, you know, because I think that this is recent, you know, until 5 years ago, until a year ago, no one addressed themselves to this problem.
We also ran into an additional problem when we were drafting the system in terms of the transportation issues, and we resolved it in a real simple way. Somebody's brought up the problem of medical journals, and then there was this whole horde of examples given of where you could go down and buy, you know, basically things that we and none of us would consider pornography, that would have, you know, things that were prohibited by this section. And we resolved it in this way by saying that if it was produced in the state, because we said, well, nobody's producing medical journals in the state of Alaska as a matter of fact, so that if it's constructed this way, you know, dealing with the people who produce it, you're not going to run into that problem.
We also added the lewd exhibition of the genitals instead of exposing just genitals.
Right. Using a child, you know, a doctor or someone using a child, if you talk about medical.
Well, it's not the doctor that does it, it's a guy that.
No, it refers to any commercial purpose, though, and the commercial purpose could
see,
be.
See, so not the doctor necessarily makes medical journals. Or, you know.
It's the advertisers.
Yes, yeah. But see, this is okay because it, nobody's producing medical journals in Alaska or you know, books or there was some other things.
I'm more scared of those.
But you know, the question of whether it's a Class C, B, or A felony, or you want to put them away from life, that's a simple policy decision, and you know, the committee can do what it wants.
What's
that
Class A felony again?
A Class A felony. The first offense would be a 15-year maximum, but the re-judge panel can go as high as 30 years, which is particularly aggravated. For a second offense, we're getting a little bit into sentencing, so get some idea. The presumptive sentence there would be 7 to 11 years, and under those circumstances, no chance of probation. Third offense, if he really likes doing that, it's 11 to 18.
How about the fine?
The fine would be
$10,000 for all felonies. And it was an organization that could go as high as $100,000 or a figure not exceeding twice the pecuniary gain. So conceivably you could have some commercial enterprise that did this that made a lot of money in Alaska as a result of it. And you could find them in amount not exceeding, I believe, twice the pecuniary gain. So you have extreme flexibility there, certainly when you're dealing with organizations, and $10,000 for a felony is certainly higher than most defenses.
In theory, I think this section occupies the proper uncovered ground. In practice, what happens when you have something like this picking up the pieces at one end and you have your sexual offenses, past eight felonies on the other? In practice, what happens? Is this a is something that we're vulnerable because you plead down to? Or is it a place where we can pick up the guy who moved the furniture into the scene? As a practical matter, does it do us any good or does it harm us?
Well, this statute is broader than you would have under the sexual offenses and is an accomplice because it covers photograph and film.
On line 22, it says he knowingly induces it or employs. So you can pick up almost anybody on the knowingly induced and accomplice. But which way does it go in practice?
You mean what does the prosecutor do? Is that your question, Mayor?
Yeah, what would be the tendency here? Would the tendency be for this provision to allow us to pick up the participants who were peripherally involved? Or is it a way for a guy to plead down to
the guy that's been prosecuted is always going to attempt to plead down, but it's going to, you know, if the prosecutor can prove the A felony, he's going to.
This is my whole point, though, in this deciding on this thing. I think the question is there, than what it says.
The only problem with that is that I think the prosecutors are going to tell you that is if you're going to write something, you know, have very stiff penalties. And then what happens when everybody wants to narrow it down because they can think of all the cases that you don't want to give somebody 30 years for doing this, then you become so narrow that other people are getting off. So generally the way the code is constructed, you have the broader offenses are at the bottom with the lower penalties, and then, you know, the more strict.
What I'm asking for is your experience. In my experience of working a police league for about 20 years, I'd rather have it than not have it. That's my opinion.
See, I could...
But I wonder what yours is.
I could go ahead and I could say, yeah, you know, you could go get these pure people under an accomplice theory to sexual offenses. In other words, he was an accomplice to the sexual assault, accomplice to the penetration. But in reality, that's a very difficult thing to establish simply because you've got to... difficult for me to just explain it here, and you know, to 12 people on the jury, it's a lot easier to point to a specific statute. My reaction would be, if you had a specific statute that would be covering it, you would be more inclined to charge under the specific, as opposed to trying to make this, you know, this approach. Well, he's an accomplice because he hired someone to engage in sexual penetration, and he can be viewed as liable for that person's acts. We have a specific statute that covers it, so. You know, there was one feeling on the commission, at least on the staff, that you didn't need this kind of statute because you had, if the prosecutor was willing to make the argument, he could.
Yeah. Is there any discussion in this particular section? It might settle 18. I'd a lot rather have seen the 16 and have an 8 felony and work out something. But I know some 17-year-old girls get out of these dance halls and stuff around the country. 17-year-old boy trying to do things. I'm always sorry
to hear you say that.
I'm 16 today.
The reason we used 18 was that, as I understand, existing law now has a policy that the age majority is 18 unless otherwise specified. And additionally, in contributing, for example, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, we used the age of 18. We wanted to expand the protection here, simply. The commission felt that, you know, I think initially it was proposed to 16-year-old, and they said, no, we should expand it to 18-year-olds.
Now, to get the point, when we really deal with children, and we different philosophy about whether a 17-year-old is a child or not, you know, I think 16 years is none of the family, so if you remember, I wanted to take 16, but it might be a very serious offense to go out and do these type of things to children 16 and under. I think you have good arguments, and that's just a no-no. Now, when you get into the 17 and 18, that's when the attorney would say, we get into court, and this girl looks like she's 26. She's been dancing at the Kit Kat Club for a year. Now, you won't give a guy 30 years or 15 years. You get into those areas where the kids are grown enough, they know the action they're taking. But by golly, at 16 and under, to do any of these things, I think I'll do an 8-year-old, you know, a very serious crime. So it lessens its seriousness. I think what you get above 16, kids are off in college at 17, doing all kinds of stuff like that.
I was going to school and I thought, what were you doing? Certainly, if it increased the penalty for it, it would be appropriate, I think, to lower the age on it.
I don't know what others, I'd like to hear some comment about that. Do you think 16, I think everybody kind of is muted in the last 2 or 3 to 16 and under, it's just no excuse for that. But gosh, I know some people that would question whether I'll give that 15 years for like 2 days and 8 years.
Well, what's the, Mr. Chairman, what's the, I've got to get a copy of your definitions of the Class A and so forth, but a Class A felony is what again?
Class A would be punishable by a maximum of 15 years in jail.
Is that in
here? No, you don't have it. You don't have that yet, and that's going to be the 6-10 draft. But the bill is out tomorrow.
There's no minimum.
For first offenses, no. Second offenses, the presumptive sentence, for second offenses, the presumptive sentence would be 7 to 11, and the 7 would be the minimum.
Okay. The reason I wasn't concerned about the age here, and I think your point's very valid, is because what judge is going to slap 15 on what judge? Who do I know who's a judge who's going to hit the limit on a chick who's
17?
See?
Randy's bill is
16.
Okay. Is there any other points or questions anybody wants to make on this section?
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions about the failure to permit visitation and the failure to provide the order of compulsion.
Okay, yeah, we just skipped over those. We just skipped over and we're going to go back.
Right. Do you want to do it continue now? Or?
No, we've got a car.
All right. Okay. But we can go in 10 minutes.
No, that's okay.
We got several other things. We'll just stop now. We got several other things to do.
Lisa, you're going to name that.
Oh, another thing for my wife.
Meeting adjourned 4:57, January 18th, 1978. Beginning House Judiciary Committee meeting January 19th, 1978.
Yeah, you're on.
All right, it's on.
About the what?
Quorum is present.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to note the absence of all three minority members. That's We've been waiting for them for 22 minutes. You want to move out the
vote? That would really upset.
No, but
if you've done
another bill.
Anything else is really good
So the record could be like that.
American reflection of the minority members are all very tardy.
What page?
I'd like to ask about this section. Thank you. First, I need a couple of background information. Barry.
Yeah.
In recent months, I've become aware of several cases where parents have separated, and either the mother or the father has taken the children and has refused to allow the other parent to feed the children and has disappeared so the other parent can't find them and so on. Now, I know this doesn't deal with that exactly, but I'm leading up to it. Is there, under present law, any right of a parent to see a child? I I mean, if one parent steals a child and takes it away, can the other parent go forward and get a visitation rights?
Well, all I could talk about, is whether it's criminal. And I'm really, in the civil side of it, I'm somewhat at a disadvantage, right? I believe you can get a TR, a temporary restraining order, injunction requiring, you know, the parent to produce the child. But we in the code have a specific crime of custodial interference, which would cover the acts of a parent taking a person from a lawful custodian.
Is that what you're talking about?
No. This is failure to permit. Let me explain something about this statute.
Okay,
the statute was passed by the legislature last year. The commission has not even gone over it.
This was in the family code thing.
I don't know how it got through. I mean, I don't know where it came. But no, I didn't mean it negatively there. But I mean, simply it passed last year. I simply just included it in the code.
Is there any major rewrite of it?
Yeah. Willfully was changed to intentionally. That's it. The other thing was the penalty. You provided a $200 fine, and we simply classified it as a violation. Yeah. Which
except for that, this is existing law,
yeah,
pretty much.
Just it is. Yeah.
This is all pursuant to court order, right?
Yes, this is pursuant to a court order, but.
So it could apply not only to parents, but to anybody else who was able to persuade the court that he should see the child.
Not really.
Well, I'm not too sure that. I think what the statute is aimed at is, you know, in a custody case, in a divorce case, where custody of the child is at stake, and the order would say you're entitled 2 days out of five, and the parent refuses to allow it. Now, if you could prove that you're keeping the child from the lawful custodian with intent to hold him permanently or for a protracted period, you would be guilty of custodial interference. Which would be, I believe, would be misdemeanor.
No, that's not
this
offense.
That is in the section on kidnapping.
Which page is that?
Well, it's TD1, page 53.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't think there's any problem worrying about this being used in any other situation, because I've never, ever seen a court order involve visitation rights of a child unless it was...